Well, by the time you guys are hearing this, this episode is happening with me right in the middle of Fast Canada and Spencer right in the middle of the state of Oregon, helping me in no ways whatsoever. But that's okay.
I'm going to use this time to break into your house and steal all my swag that you're holding on to.
It's literally overflowing. You'd be doing me a favor. Just dust before you leave. That'd be great. Anyway, but yeah, it's, and here's the thing, like, I'm not in Canada yet, but I have a guess of kind of what it's going to be like, in Canada.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I do. At least visually, I don't think I'm going to tell the difference. I think it'll be exactly the same. It's just going to look, because I've seen pictures, right? I'm like, this looks the same. It's entirely the same. And you know, when you wake up in a strange place, like you go to sleep at like a friend's house or you're camping and your brain's kind of shocked and you kind of have you kind of like got to figure out your bearings. I don't think that's going to happen. I think I'm going to wake up and think I missed my flight. And that's going to be the only thing.
Which I'm still at home.
That's not an insult. Like, I live in a very beautiful place in our country. You know, that's a good thing. But yeah, that's what I think is going to happen. But yeah, Fast Canada, it's going on right now. Check out our social media. We'll be posting stuff about Fast Canada on there. We're also going to post a video that was blood, sweat, and tears and a little bit of musical talent about Medic Grinds Coffee. That is... It's one of those ideas that got away from us because we think we're funny. And yeah, so go check out our social media. It should be up there to air tomorrow. I'm proud of it. I don't care if you are or not, Spence. I like it.
I'm proud of it.
All right,
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm proud of it.
You wrote it, so you should stand by it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spencer, I am like an AI prompt for Spencer, right? Like, you can be like, make me an image of this. And then sometimes you're like, that's really good. Other times you're like, what is going on with the hands? And so I like to give Spencer the same thrill of AI, except taking about 400 times as long. So with even more questionable results. We're all getting replaced. Let's roll the intro. This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of EMS 2020.
I'm going to get some water. Be right back.
Dude, he does this just to hurt me. I want the audience to know. I want you all to know. This is just to hurt me. Yeah, welcome back.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Hey, I'm back with water. And if you guys would like to talk about me getting water, which I know you absolutely obviously do, then you can check out our social media. We are EMS2020 on Facebook and at EMS2020 Show on Instagram. On there, you'll find a post about this call and a post about many of our other calls. So give us a like and a follow. We also now post clips of the podcast up there. Thanks to our sponsor for XShare Clips. That's XShare. That's going to be on there as well. And so if you want to submit a call to EMS2020, have your call on this show where we will actually review it and give our feedback, which, you know, maybe listen to an episode first before you take that plunge. But if you want that to be you, then you can check out EMS2020.com. There's a big button that says submit a call. You can also check out our merch. There's links there for the merch. And you can really help support the show. The best way to support the show is not just merch, actually beyond merch, is to sign up for the EMS2020 Continuing Education. We have an exclusive episode that we're going to announce very, very soon, along with a little teaser preview, probably as Fast Canada winds down here. But it'll be a place where you can earn continuing education for listening to EMS2020 and get exclusive episodes. And for those of you that don't sign up, don't worry. You're not getting anything that you don't already have. We're not taking episodes away from y'all. We're just giving episodes to people who want to help support the show. It's super cheap. It's like $39 a year. Like a whole year is $39. And you divide 39 by 12 and you get a month. And you can do that math on your own. It's going to be a little, I don't know, around $3 or so, you know? So a little over $3. A little over $3.
99.
No, it's just 39 even.
What?
I don't know why. Yeah.
I don't understand why we're good. All right.
Yeah.
$3.25.
And as hard as that was, I want you guys to now realize just how much dedication goes into converting things to metric. If that little bit of math was that hard for us, then then you know.
Then you appreciate you know. It.
Yeah. Oh, look, gosh.
What that's 300 pennies and 5 nickels.
Anyway, so Spencer, what you got?
Today's call was submitted to us by a paramedic I've dubbed Dorothy for this episode. Dorothy has been in EMS for about 4 years at the time of this call, and they've been a paramedic for about one of those years. They've spent the bulk of their time as an EMT, then an EMT advanced, working on an ambulance for a high volume city ambulance service. They said they love their time on the ambulance, as you never know what you're going to do in a day. They're currently working at a smaller service now, and report for the most part that it's really more of a routine to their day. And that's something, you know, it's like, they're like, hey, we're going to start shift and then like go down to the, you know, county diner and, you know, get breakfast.
That'd be great.
Whereas like, I know. Whereas like, can you imagine when we worked?
No.
Everyone's going like, actually dispatch, belay that order. We're going down to the Chipotle.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine going into a Chipotle personally, but even still, I couldn't even imagine if I had the option.
I got nervous getting fast food because I was like, what if it's not fast enough?
Oh, 100%. Getting fast food. The kind of partners I didn't like working with were the ones that always really wanted to like shoot for the moon on the food they were going to get, right? Like, I was always like, hey, the kind of food you need to get is stuff that's going to be made quickly and you just need to go. And we need to have good access getting out of the parking lot. I worked with a partner that would just be like he loved Potbelly. And Potbelly, by the way, fucking delicious. Their sandwiches are amazing. But okay. The parking lot is atrocious to park an ambulance in. It takes time to just sit there and make food. And the thing that sucks the most is you don't pay until you get it at the end, which on one hand is nice because if you don't get your food, you don't pay. But on the other hand, you feel really bad and it looks really crappy to be in your uniform to order food and then ditch it.
Yep.
Later on. But he would always want to go to this place. He would just park the ambulance in the middle of the lot, trapping cars in. And he'd just be like, well, we're going to be out of here soon. I'm just like, God, I don't want to be here right now. I don't want this.
Yeah, no, that sounds anxiety ridden. I thought I lucked out one time. We went to a like, hey, all you could eat buffet, like you weigh your buffet food. And we got a call like halfway through and there was a line. And so we like, I had to just put the food down.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This is unusable to everybody.
It's just,
we have to
it's
leave.
It's just a tray just sitting there sadly. Yep. While you ditch it. Oh, that is hilarious.
Anyway, so lots more opportunity to do that in a smaller system, you know, where there's time to sit down maybe. Yeah. All right. So for this call, they are working with an EMT I've dubbed Brainy Scarecrow.
Okay.
The relationship is described as a great one. They're at the point now where like they are both anticipating each other's flow on calls.
Nice.
They also get to do some extensive pre-gaming. And Brainy Scarecrow, shortened now because that's going to be a mouthful, to BCS, gets credited for asking questions or bringing up ideas that Dorothy hasn't considered because, by the way, at the time of this call, they were in paramedic school. So, yay! So, this is a hospital-based EMS service, Oz, Arks County. I've dubbed the service that they're working for as Munchkin Medical Response, a proud EMS division of the Sisters of Munchkin Providence Medical Group, LLC.
Nice.
I don't know if there is any hospital that's actually an LLC, but there is now.
That would be a difficult setup. Well, it's a very business bro-y thing for us. Yeah. EMS 2020, now giving financial advice that you should definitely follow with no strings attached to that whatsoever. Our lawyers approve, and so will yours.
Yep. All right.
Also,
so
throw your protocol book out the window of your ambulance while you drive down the street. Just turn on EMS 2020. You get a call. Try and find that episode.
Yeah, just
I hope it's obvious to do none of the fucking things I just said. None of them.
You just got to fast forward. We just got to get through this rant about bringing your kits.
Well, if they didn't bring on their kits, then that's the perfect part. All you're doing is proving my point. Crap, should have started there. That's where it's going bad. Anyway, I'm sorry, man. Continue.
All right. So the Ozarks is a rural county with like a town city in it. It's got a downtown area, several neighborhoods like dotted throughout. The service runs less than 5 911 ambulances on in a day. The crew work 24-hour shifts, and the majority of the shifts are staffed medic, with only a few staffed as EMT paramedic.
Okay.
Mind blown.
Wow.
I know.
You wrote down where this is, right?
I mean, I wrote down that it was in Ozarks County.
I want to know where it really is because I may apply. That sounds delicious. That's amazing.
I don't ask. And people, oddly enough, don't really often tell me.
That's smart. That's smart.
All right. So the crews run 6 to 12 calls per shift. Hospital choice doesn't factor in this call, so I'll leave it out.
Okay.
Now, I did specify that this is a 911 division, and they do occasionally do interfacility transfers, but this area also has an ALS interfacility division, which is entirely separate. Like, it's a separate entity from Munchkin Medical Response. So gotcha. While these crews can do interfacility, the interfacility folks are not doing the 911 calls.
Okay.
All right. There are many fire departments, one paid, multiple volunteer, all at a BLS EMR level, with the exception of the folks who work for both Munchkin Medical Response and for the fire departments. They are constrained to the level of the agency that they are working for at the time they're working for them, unless it's necessary. Like, if they're like, oh, God, we got to intubate this person. And, you know, like the one paramedic has tried and the other one has no hands. And they're like, I got to do this. Then what they would do is they would clock in, essentially, so that they are covered for the time that they spent working as a paramedic.
Gotcha, gotcha.
But anyway, that's how that would work. I do want to say that Dorothy spoke very highly of this service. The retention is insanely high.
Yeah.
They've got like decade long employees. There's little turnover, lots of camaraderie. It sounds like they have really supportive managers.
All right. What country is this in?
No, like, well, Ozarks. So, you know,
yeah.
Just over the rainbow away. All right.
Okay. Sounds good.
Which brings us to the call. So it's about 10 p.m. And according to Dorothy, the day hadn't been that bad.
That's a great way to. Was it quiet?
It's very slow. Yeah.
Gotcha.
What's the worst that could happen, guys?
Yeah.
So they were at the station. Dinner is digesting in their bellies. Bed calling their names. Bed's calling. Bed immediately gets sent to voicemail. And Bed should have texted instead of calling.
Dang it.
Because Dorothy and Brainy Scarecrow get tapped out to respond to a cardiac arrest at 1939 Yellow Brick Road.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Is that the year that the story was written? 1939?
I think it's the year the movie came out.
Oh, wow, boy. In Technicolor?
I don't know. Now I'm doubting it. Yeah, now I'm doubting it. Google it.
I don't know. Sure. You keep going. I'll figure that out.
All right. The address this call takes place at is immediately familiar to our crew. This is the home of a 65-year-old male, a Mr. W.W. West. Now, there are several flavors of frequent flyer. Some folks are just medically fragile.
It was 1939. My goodness.
Sweet. Thank God.
In Technicolor. All right. Yeah. Cool.
So frequent flyers and their flavors. We've got some that are just medically fragile. Like there are just brittle diabetics whose blood sugar just cannot be controlled despite all of their best, you know, care. Or there's those that are just very public, you know, like they're constantly drunk and, you know, people see them and they're like, oh God, that person needs help. Or, you know, mentally ill and, you know, thus an EMS response gets summoned. Or some have just chronic medical conditions and a lack of resources, you know, like we constantly go on people who are like, well, it's my, you know, it's my whatever it is, you know, bowler's hat again. And, you know, I don't have a way to get to the hospital and my doctor says I have to go, kind of a thing. A lot of these, you know, like we think of, you know, frequent flyers as fairly like derogatory, but some of them are like, they're sympathetic and there's nice people.
What is probably the case is there are probably, far fewer inappropriate frequent flyers than we like to think. I think we just really quickly kind of search for the bad sometimes, which is not good. And I will tell you, as someone who is getting into their 40s, I need more medical care than I did. Not a lot. I'm a very healthy 40-year-old. But, you know, every now and then, like, a knee stops working or, like, just things don't – other things. Like, I did have an incident where I had some really bad symptoms. Not emergency room bad, but they're like, yeah, we can see you in 4 weeks. A specialist can see you in 4 weeks. And I'm like, I don't know if I can make it to 4 weeks. Like, well, then you can go to the ER. I'm like, but I'm not ER bad. And so there's a lot of people – who end up using emergency services, whether it's the ER or the ambulance, because it's not bad now, but it will be if I just rely on the healthcare system we have to get me there. And I think that's one of the things we need to bear in mind. Yeah. Depending on, you know, it can change. Like that's not true for everybody, but it's true for a lot of people. So, and I think you have another category of frequent flyer of the person who just doesn't know any better. I think.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I think we have to remember though is that people call 911 when something is outside of their control, and that's going to change from person to person, when there's something they just really don't know what to do. And for some people, you know, depending on the resources they've had available in life and how they've been taught and those kind of things, their line is going to be maybe different than where it should be or different than where you think it should be, you know. And so that's one of the other things to keep in mind. The only, I would say, truly inappropriate frequent flyers are the people who know that they are abusing the system, know that there's a better way that they could be handling this issue, and call anyways. For example, we used to have a frequent flyer in our area who would frequently complain of chest pain and then demand to go to a hospital that was all the way across town, get out and leave AMA. He was just using us to get back and forth from town. That's entirely inappropriate, you know, like that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, even frequent flyers, there is usually a, even if it's not appropriate, it's very rarely a malicious act. So anyway, that's just kind of one of the things I wanted to point out is that, what is it? Don't assume malice when incompetence can, or maybe that's, maybe that's not a good term for this one.
Yeah. Don't assume malice where, you know, incompetent, but incompetence being like, or ignorance, where ignorance can best explain. There's a plethora of reasons that patients can become you know, the frequent flyers. Again, not all of them are bad. Some of them are downright pleasant, but some of them are Mr. W.W. West.
Perfect.
W.W. West is a 65-year-old male, well-known to Munchkin Medical in the Ozarks. He is one of those folks who's very frequent, like near daily encounters with EMS. Described by Dorothy as just really a pain in the ass. He's a complex patient on dialysis, doesn't take care of themselves, doesn't go to, often misses dialysis appointments because they, you know, for who knows, you know.
Yeah.
they, and then, you know, they call EMS because, like, oh, I'm symptomatic. Never, you know, not a healthy person. Never seen a blood pressure under 190.
Wow.
Also a chronic drug user with, and not in a, and not in any specific, like a poly farm, like, hey, what you got? All right, that'll work.
Kind
of situation. So, and we're still like, and those things are tough to deal with, right? Like it can be hard when you see somebody, you're like, if there was just a little more effort in, you know, put into place, like if you got your meds, if you know, whatever, like there's system pieces too, but there's also an account of like, what are you doing to help your situation? Those are understandable struggles already. What sucks is when it's all of that plus the person just is mean.
Yeah.
And this is that person. They are, you know, yelling. They are not compliant with EMS. Yeah. They are belittling. You know.
See, and that is where I draw a line. You know, like I'm very understanding about frequent flyers, but my understanding's cut short when it comes to people who are verbally abusive to responders. That doesn't yep. have any place in it. And it's one of those things where one of my favorite phrases I've learned from somebody that's not me that I'm butchering the quote on is that your behavior is, and trust me, there are things that lead to people doing that kind of stuff. But it's one of those things where I'm like, I love the quote, and that is, your behavior is understandable, but it's not excusable.
Yeah.
And it's like, I understand why you're here. So that's where it comes down to. You know, like I said, I want to be understanding of why people may need to use 911, but I'm not here to allow responders to be verbally abused or further endangered. Because the biggest thing I don't like about verbal abuse is that thing that you only know if it's safe after the fact. You know what I mean? And by safe, I mean physically safe. I'm not counting all the other types of trauma we can endure from patients. Yeah. But I'm talking in terms of physical trauma. You only know it's not going to escalate until the call's done. You know, I mean, there are plenty of stories out there about, oh yeah, that guy always talks trash, but he's harmless until one day he stabs a responder. You know, and so when someone elevates and they're angry and they're demeaning and they're verbally abusive, I the hairs in the back of my neck go up because I don't know when are they going to take this to the next level. They clearly have no problem walking right up to this line. They've clearly passed several social barriers that I would never dream of passing just in the way they've spoken. What's the next barrier they're going to cross? So, I will say I don't tolerate a lot of verbal abuse. I try and be as understanding as I can, and I try and de-escalate where I can. But no, I just want to make it clear that I'm not trying to make excuses for anyone that verbally abuses people. But anyway,
I do want to make a point, though, that like some of this, you know, it's like when we encounter people that we often encounter and they are negative, there's a part of me that kind of wonders, all right, what were previous encounters like? Because I do know that, you know, it's like sometimes people have a lack of patience for, you know, for what they, you know, it's like, man, this doesn't ever get better. This guy, you know, continues to call. He doesn't, we're not needed. This isn't really an emergency. This is a failure of the healthcare system.
Yeah.
And the person who represents that happens to be the patient. And so therefore, you know, like they treat the patient poorly. But and then you compound that over multiple times. And now you have a patient who's like, I have to call them because I don't have a better way. But God, they're assholes every time they show up.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, like then you have patients who are like, why would I treat them well? They don't treat me well. We just have I need you to go to take me to a place. We don't have to like each other. You just have to take me there.
Yeah.
And that is not, and again, that isn't to justify anyone's behavior. But, you know, I think again, like you said, understanding the genesis of that, is helpful. Not to excuse it, but to try to find ways to mitigate it. You know, and the best way is, like you said, it's try and diffuse the situation. So Dorothy and BSC, they go en route. They pregame for a cardiac arrest. They assign their roles. They talk about what they're going to do. They also bring up, hey, we should add calcium and maybe bicarb into the cardiac arrest algorithm because this is a dialysis patient. And so they are responding lights and sirens. And yes, their siren did sound like O-E-O.
Yo.
Yo.
O-E-O. Very well. I like it. That would be awesome. But it gives the image of a very slow plodding ambulance, though.
O-E-O.
Yeah, exactly. Go faster. And I'm sorry, you said this was a call for a code 99?
Yeah, this is a call for a cardiac arrest.
Gotcha.
At 1939 Yellow Brick Road. So, at the 10-minute mark of their responding, and about a minute before their ambulance arrives, they are surprised to hear Toto on the radio. And Toto, a firefighter with flying hose monkey fire, Toto gets on the radio and tells the responding units, the patient is unconscious, but this is not a cardiac arrest. But it's now 11 minutes after being dispatched and our crew arrive on scene to 1939 Yellow Brick Road, and they find the very familiar, somewhat run-down home. They spot the patient sitting up in a lawn chair on the front porch with two firefighters next to them. The crew back their ambulance into the driveway. They park about 6 feet from the front porch where they normally do. They get their stretcher out and get to the patient. So they park, exit the ambulance as the two firefighters come help unload the stretcher, and Dorothy can see our patient. So Mr. W.W. West is about 5'9" and between 160 to 180 pounds. That is 175 centimeters tall and between 72 and 81 kilograms. Described as easily yeetable.
I actually already like this guy a little better now, though, to be honest. Yeah.
So, the patient appears unconscious, but is exhibiting some twitching in their limbs every so often. There is an older sibling of the patient on scene who tells the crew, I think he's dead. The porch is very dark. There is very poor lighting. They rolled a nat one on lighting. So,
oh, gotcha.
Yeah. All right. So Dorothy goes right over to the patient, shakes their shoulder. The patient groans and maybe says something incomprehensible, and they also swat Dorothy's hand away. So definitely not dead.
Gotcha.
Dorothy does a trapezius pinch, and the patient opens their eyes, makes eye contact, and then just kind of like shuts their eyes and slumps back down. So Dorothy tries to interact with the patient, asking questions, trying to get them to wake up with some improvement. The patient does become more aroused with like the continued interaction, but like that doesn't change their mental status overall, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
A quick ABC here is, you know, airways patent. Breathing is noted to be slow and shallow, and they did not check for pulse or skin at this time because really, like, they're like, hey, it's dark here. The stretcher is literally right next to me. Let's get this patient over to the stretcher and into the ambulance.
Gotcha. What time of day is this?
This is 10 p.m.
10 p.m. All right, so it is dark. Yep. And how old was the patient again? I'm sorry, you said it. I forgot it.
65.
65. Okay, so 65-year-old male in a dark and stormy night. All right, I don't know if it's stormy. I made that up.
Well, I mean, there's probably a tornado warning, but, you know.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, not well done, sir.
Thank you. All right, well done. So the family...
Which really... They may not even need to worry about transporting the patient whatsoever. It could just happen. Tornado comes in, sweeps up the house, boom! Lands in the hospital.
And you were there, and you were there. Yeah.
And a doctor was there, and a nurse was there.
All right. So for the history that they are able to get from the family, they say that they arrived about 15 minutes ago to find the patient like this. No known last seen normal time. So Dorothy tells Mr. W.W. West to stand up so they can move him to the stretcher. They want to move the patient to the ambulance where there's better lighting and, you know, their equipment. So with some repeated instruction and insistence, the patient is able to stand up and bear weight. Although, unfortunately, the patient doesn't or isn't able to follow the instructions to take a few steps forward to the stretcher. They also appear unsteady. So Dorothy, okay. Toto, and... I guess we'll call him Tin Man, the other firefighter.
Why not?
He's got a heart. Yeah.
He's wields an axe, and firefighters have axes.
Dude, there it is. Thank you. All right.
You're welcome.
They grab the patient's leg. So Dorothy grabs the shoulders. They grab the patient's legs, and the three of them like carry the patient just a few steps over to the stretcher. The patient then gets placed into the back of the ambulance where, BSC jumps in to grab a set of baseline vitals. So thoughts at this juncture, Chris.
All right. So thoughts at my juncture. How long have we been on scene and with the patient for?
I would say like 2 minutes tops at this point.
Gotcha.
This is kind of a quick.
Pretty quick. Yeah. All right. Okay, so a couple things. First, I'm a little concerned. I'm like, why haven't really checked for, you know, baseline vitals at all? But then I do remember the thought process of like, hey, it's dark out here. And we've talked about this on the show before. And that is that if you can't treat a patient where they are, even rapid things that need to be done and checked right away, if you can't actually check those because, you know, the patient's, you know, in a room that you can't access to or you can't see anything, then what you really need to do is get them to a place where you can see them or improve your lighting situation by rolling a dice and hoping that Spencer helps you out. But no, then you have to think of moving the patient as a critical intervention at that point. If the patient's current position or location is preventing you from doing what you got to do, then yeah, you got to move them. So that's all well and good. I'm not really worried about it there. But yeah, my thoughts so far is I'm going to treat this like any other altered LOC patient. And one of the things to remember about altered LOC is that your body kind of has one main job. I mean, it's not its only job. I guess it's got two. One is keep the brain alive, and then the other is make babies. Like, that's what it does, right?
Make more brains.
make more brains. Keep this brain alive, make more brains. One of the key ways it has to keep your brain alive is everything your brain needs or doesn't need is going to be either put in there by the blood, by your circulatory system, or taken out of there by your circulatory system. So if your brain is, so if your body is not perfusing your brain, it's failing at its one job, and that's a big deal because your body has, or if your brain, if you're altered, essentially, if you have an altered mental status, your brain is not getting what it needs, and that's a big deal, right? Because your body's one job is to make sure that thing keeps functioning. And it has a lot of safeguards in place to make sure that keeps happening. Okay. Your body can tolerate a lot before it starts shutting off the lights. The lights are getting shut off. So altered LOC could be anything from, oh, it's just some sugar to a peri-arrest patient. So I like to do my, my altered LOC song and dance. I've done it on the show before. And that is the very first thing I like to know is fuel getting to the brain? Period. Okay. In other words, do we have a blood pressure? Are we producing enough pressure to get the fuel to the brain? Second thing is the fuel any good? Does it have oxygen in it? And does it have sugar in it? That's the other thing that I like to look at. Once I get the fuel down, okay, and those are things you need to correct right away. Okay. Once I get the fuel down, my next question is, all right, is it broken? All right. So yeah. If it's broken, is there a fall recently? And that's going to come with a lot of history. And unless it was witnessed or you're being called for a fall, you may have to do a little bit of digging to see if there's a mechanism for trauma. Even when the patient, even if everyone else on scene is like, I think it, you know, doesn't even seem to mention trauma, or maybe they believe it's a medical issue, ask, hey, did they fall at all? Well, yeah, I guess they did fall yesterday. You know, that's something that happens. Are they having a stroke? Okay, can they complete a stroke scale? If you can't get them to verbally complete a stroke scale, because you do need people to be able to follow commands, then you can check for other things. Like, are they favoring one side? You know, when we're trying to stand him up, is his right arm not moving or his left arm not moving? Those kind of things. Yeah. Look for those. And then after that, you know, I usually like to look at sepsis. Okay. Do we have an infection brewing? And usually sepsis is going to impact your altered LOC. Well, there's a lot of ways it can impact your LOC. One of those ways is by reducing the blood pressure, right? Because our vasculature gets so big in sepsis, we become shocky, right? And also our vasculature becomes leaky and fluid leaks out and doesn't go where it needs to go. So the blood pressure drops. But another way that someone can be altered from sepsis is just plain old toxicity from the infection they have going on. That can cause the altered level of consciousness as well. And then we can move on to things like, are they intoxicated? Okay. Is there a presence of intoxicants? Sounds like this guy has a history of intoxicants. Okay. And then past that, we can go to things like, is this behavioral? Okay. And while all of these layers are important and need to be addressed by EMS in one way or another, I like to save behavioral for the very last because you don't want to start with that one because behavioral, while important, is very rarely a life threat. If it is a life threat, it's because of like an SI attempt, in which case it's really falling into one of the other categories, right? Like we are intoxicated or we've taken something that is making it to where we can't deliver the fuel anymore. Like we took medications that are preventing our heart from beating as fast as it can be. Those kind of things. So anyway, that is my general altered LOC approach. Also consider using the AIOU TIPS acronym. Google it. I'm not going to talk about it here. But anyway, there you go. So those are my thoughts. I want to start putting those pieces together.
Okay. Yeah. And I have thoughts as well. I will save them for after the call. In the ambulance, the patient's pupils and lung sounds are checked while Brainy Scarecrow can obtain some vitals. Pupils are noted to be pinpoint. Lungs are clear. The patient continues to exhibit slow and shallow breathing. Given the history of the patient with previous overdoses and, you know, the signs that point in this case towards an opioid overdose, they decide to give the patient 2 milligrams Narcan intranasal. Vitals are taken shortly after that, or the, you know, completed shortly after that. So here's what we have. GCS is 9. They gave a 2, eye open to pain, incomprehensible speech on verbal. And then 5 is, like not localizes, but like withdraws from pain. They got respirations of 8, SpO2 in the low 90s, end tidal CO2 of 48 millimeters of mercury. They do not recall what the blood pressure was, but hypertensive. Again, see my previous comment about never saw anything below 190. So presuming above 190. Heart rate is 80, and the blood sugar is checked, and it is 166 milligrams per deciliter, or 9.2 millimoles.
Okay. Now,
under the better lighting and with no real improvement in the patient's mental status, Dorothy notes what could be construed as some right-sided facial droop. Additionally, they recall now that the patient's actions, like swatting them away and the twitching, have been with the left hand versus like their patient's right hand. The patient's twitching also has favored that left side as well. So they do a BFAST stroke assessment, some of it anyway. And the patient has a significantly weaker grip on their right side. They have the facial droop, and they add in like, yeah, we didn't check their gait like in this moment, but like previously we witnessed them trying to take a few steps and they were unsteady. So they decide that this is a stroke alert. And while they are doing the stroke assessment, their partner performs a 12 lead as per their protocol. It was unremarkable. Well, at this time, Dorothy tells everyone, if you don't want to go to Mother of Kansas, no place like hospital stroke center, you need to get out of the ambulance now. Because the firefighters, Tin Man and Toto had jumped in as well. And by the way, hospital choice wasn't an option. This is the closest hospital and it's their stroke center. So, yep. So BSC gets up front to drive and everyone else clears out.
Okay.
So, regarding medical history, this is an interesting thing that I have heard of, but I have not really seen it in action, which is they can pull up medical history from the patient from their charting because...
Oh, my good. What mecca of an ambulance agency is this? Like, dual paramedic cars, you can apparently just go to restaurants on duty and it's not a problem. And then like the charting program features actually work.
Somewhere
over the rainbow. Is that why you picked this theme?
No.
Man. Sorry. Yeah. I'm still just blown away that they actually have a chart feature that works.
All right. So for allergies, they don't recall. Because they don't have their charting system up when I took the call. For medications, they recall that the patient took Keppra. And they don't recall if there were other medications or if the patient was compliant. But they do know that Keppra was one of the only medications that the patient did try to be compliant with. And that was because Keppra is an anti-seizure medication. So we know they have a history of seizures. We also know that they have dialysis and they have a dialysis port in their right chest. That they frequently miss dialysis and that they have a Polypharm drug use history and severe hypertension. So those are the ample pieces.
That is an ample amount of self-destructive behavior.
It's true.
It is. Oh, okay. All right. Let's keep. Nailed it. All right.
So the transport to the stroke center is going to take around 30 minutes. And right at the start, the patient gets placed on 4 liters per minute of oxygen on a nasal cannula, which improves their SpO2 value, bringing it up into the mid to high 90s. They do get another dose of 2 milligrams IN Narcan because, despite the belief that this is a stroke, there's also, it's like, hey, two things can be wrong at the same time mentality yes. going on here.
And I they like are noticing- that mentality.
They are noticing that the patient's respiratory rate is still about 8 a minute. They still have pinpoint pupils, and the mentation has not changed with the previous administration. So they're going like, okay, maybe it's still this. I do want to point out at this point that RSI is not an option for this crew, not to imply that this should have been done, but just to for everyone to have kind of a clear understanding of limitations for the system. Okay.
Is that foreshadowing?
Maybe.
All right.
Maybe not. Dorothy does attempt 2 IVs during this time without success. 10 minutes into the transport, Dorothy follows the directions of their stroke protocol, which mandate a call into the designated stroke phone line at the hospital, which literally just goes to the ED desk. And in this case, generates a bunch of confusion to the point where they're like, hey, just radio in. So brings up the whole thing of like, why have this? But that's a horse of a different color. So we're going to move on. Ultimately, yeah, they radio in. At this point, the patient's oxygenation has improved, but no other vitals have really changed, including mentation, respiratory rate, or pupils. So they decide, what the hell, third time's a charm, 2 milligrams Narcan intranasal. All right. And it's just around this time that the patient starts to rouse and even becomes conversant, to the point of like, patient, what's going on? Why am I here? And I don't know exactly how they said. It's probably like, what's going on? Why am I here? And Dorothy, your family member called. And they're like, my who? What family? What? So we have a change in the patient's condition, and Dorothy reassesses. They do another CVA assessment, and the patient's facial droop and weakness on that right side have significantly diminished. The patient is now able to talk clearly, but there is still some very significant confusion. They are not at baseline, and Dorothy would know. This is a frequent patient that they go on, so they're very familiar with what the patient's normal mental status would be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the patient, albeit confused about the events, doesn't have any complaints. They don't have any pain, nausea, headache, you name it. They don't have it. Just they don't know what's going on. All right. So Dorothy, still concerned, tries again for another IV. However, Mr. W.W. West pulls their arm away from them with an ow, which, of course, yields no success. So by the time they arrive to the hospital, the patient is 100% back to baseline, is very irritated with Dorothy. In the hospital, Dr. Marvel quickly makes their way into the room and performs a very negative BFAS stroke assessment on Mr. W.W. West. And then glares at Dorothy because this hospital is also very familiar with this patient and they don't like this either. As Dorothy exited the ED, they could hear the patient bemoaning their care. I don't know why they brought me here. What a world. What a world.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, that is the call. Let's do a quick end of summary, and I will bring up why I picked this call.
Will you? Okay. Do you have any follow-up for this one? Or do you want to do that later?
I do have some follow-up. Yeah, you'll have to wait.
All right. Perfect. So quick end of call summary. So our plucky crew get dispatched to a house that they know all too well. a frequent flyer, if you will. And they had it out there, but this time it was for a code 99. They're headed to a call. It ends up being a code 99. So they're thinking, okay, well, this might not be the usual run of the mill for this fella, as this fella normally is he has a history of drug abuse, is normally quite abusive and combative with responders. And this time, though, it sounds like, you know, things may be working. And what I really like is they did a really good pregame in the sense that they start talking about, hey, this is a dialysis patient. Let's start thinking about electrolytes on the way in as well, like calcium and mag and those kind of things. Oh, they arrived to find their guy with, what was it, like a son or a brother or somebody that was with him?
Older sibling.
Older sibling that says, hey, I think he's dead. And the guy is clearly not dead. So there's that. The area, however, is quite dark and they need to assess this guy because it's 10 p.m. at night. And they're like, hey, we need to assess this guy, but we can't effectively do it here. I don't know if they said that or not. I'm hoping they said that. Then they moved the guy into the back of the ambulance, did a set of vitals, found some low saturations and some pinpoint pupils and presumed, hey, with this guy's history, Narcan seems like the way to go. But Narcan does not do anything. And so they're like, well, what's going on with this guy? And they start to notice, hey, I don't think he was moving one side of his body. So they say this might be a stroke. They try some more Narcan anyway, with the wonderful thought process that I love that, you know, more than one thing can be wrong with anybody, with somebody. And they go down that route with the whole stroke thing. They try Narcan again and then again, and then the patient comes back and is their normal self, just in time to roll into the ED and spread disbelief and doubt. As this guy is very angry with the ED, and the ED is very clearly very angry with Dorothy. So there's that. That's the summary. I think I got it. I think I nailed it.
I think you nailed it. So there's a couple reasons I picked this call. One, I like it because this is one of the like quintessential problems that exists in EMS, is that you can find a patient in a very like horrible condition, and then you can take them to the hospital, and sometime in between that, they get better or they change. Yeah. And then you get there and you're like, I swear to fucking God they were dead. And they're like, the hospital kind of does that like, I don't know. Oh, they seem pretty alive to me. And you're like, they were fucking dead. I promise you, they were dead. And they're like, okay, but maybe. And that's, and then it sucks. Or like, you know, in this situation, you have what seems to be a clear stroke that suddenly changes. And, you know, resolves. And then you get to the hospital and you're like, I swear to God, half their body didn't work. And the hospital's like, well, it's working now. And you're like, yeah, I know. Yeah. But
oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I think this is a wonderful call that highlights it. And I think there's some interesting things that took place here that I think we should highlight. So,
yeah.
Let's dive into it.
Yeah, so I do like this call because it's happened to a lot of us, and this is almost, I want to say it's, so you and I often talk about how like, hey, like, you know, err on the side of your patients, you know,
yeah,
go the extra mile if you can, you know, if you're gonna take a guess of it, well, it's either nothing or it's something, go with something, because that'll protect your patient and your certification at the same time. Not that your certification's that important, you know, when compared next to a human life, but you know, it's important to you and your family. Yeah. So anyway,
you worked hard for it.
Yeah, exactly. Keep it. Why not? You know, so there's that. But this is kind of the downside of that is, you know, it can, if you're not careful, it's a slippery slope. And I kind of hate that term, but you can kind of end up in this thing where you overreact and then people don't trust your judgment anymore, you know? And I understand being in that situation and being like, oh man, you know, like, I don't want to be that guy. And in this case, it doesn't even sound like you are that guy. Like, Dorothy sounds like he gave him a lot of Narcan, okay? And he had deficits on one side. So,
yeah.
I mean, what else are you going to do? And here's the hardest part about patients like this with this history is that this guy is at risk for a stroke. more so than other people that you're going to run into. In fact, oftentimes people with addiction histories or issues with lifestyle where they're non-compliant with medications and those kind of things, they are far more likely to have a serious problem than people who aren't. But for some odd reason, we are far more likely to ignore it when they do have a serious problem because we think it's going to be same old, same old.
Yeah. Yeah. I think applying that to this case, it's like, okay, what happened in this case? So there's a couple things that could be playing into it. Like it could be a TIA. I think that's the most obvious, thought is that, it's a, a clot formed, but then, the body got rid of it just before they got to the hospital. And that is, it's a dynamic process, another thing that could be a factor here is the patient does have a history of seizures. There is a phenomenon called Todd's paresis, which can cause, after a seizure, unilateral deficits. I have gone on a patient who had this and I was like, this guy is having a massive stroke. And then it resolved by the time we got to the hospital and it was preceded by a seizure, not a loss of consciousness type seizure, but a partial complex seizure. It's like, okay, what is Todd's paresis or Todd's paralysis, depending on where you are, what you've learned?
I kind of like this answer, actually, of it being a seizure, to the point that when you started bringing up the patient's Keppra and those kind of things, and that's the one the patient's actually compliant with, it makes me kind of feel that this patient might have seizures often. And that's why, because it's, I think the hard part about a lot of medications for people is that the problem it solves is not necessarily in front of your face, right? Like high blood pressure, that's a number on a monitor. It's not like you're walking around. You're like, oh, my toe hurts so bad. My high blood pressure is acting up. That's usually not what's going on.
Not typically.
Not typically. Exactly. So that's not going to be the case. But in the case of seizures, that messes your day up. If you had plans, even if your plan was just to sit at home and do nothing, which is a great plan, by the way, I highly recommend it when you can.
But 5 stars to staying at home doing nothing. Okay. Yeah.
But imagine, Spence, one day your wife's like, hey, I'm going to take the kids up to the grandparents. You're going to be at work. So when you get home, we're not going to be back till the next morning. So, don't catch up. And you go home and there's nothing to do. There's no chores. There's just your PlayStation. And that's it. Could you imagine that day? We're not recording. There's no editing. And then you have a seizure in the middle of it and have to go to the hospital because your neighbor saw it and doesn't know you have a seizure disorder. And then you just wind up losing the whole day. Yeah. How disappointing that would be.
Oh,
so this guy's probably pretty motivated to take his Keppra so he can get back to his scheduled nothing, which again, that's not a dig. It's envy. That's all that is. But anyway, so yeah, I can. So yeah, that's probably why he takes his Keppra. So it makes me think that, it might be why, I don't know. But it makes me think this seizure thing is oh gosh, it really kind of hits the money. Now you're bringing this Todd's paresis stuff that I didn't know. But now I think Todd's paresis, I just imagine Todd from BoJack Horseman having a stroke.
Todd. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yay. But he's having a stroke.
Todd's palsy is the other one that it's called. I was trying to remember the other name for it.
All right.
And the internet provided. So well, either thank way, you, internet.
The best part about this though is this really seems to fit, right? Because it now looks like a postictal phase that gradually improved and that the Narcan just maybe had nothing to do with it the entire time. It's a possibility.
With the twitching beforehand. Sure. Yeah. Could be a seizure.
Yeah. Could be a seizure. And now we're postictal and we're just kind of out of it until we're gradually not. And the guys, man,
I thought I was reaching when I was coming for this. I was really just using this as hey, there are potential, TIA was where I was at. But
yeah.
Now you've sold me on what was going to be the toss away potential diagnosis.
There's another thing that we always have to consider, and that is it could just be that he just happened to favor those hands for whatever reason. He favored that hand, and it was never paralyzed in the first place. That's kind of the downside to subjective observation when you don't have a patient to follow commands. It could just be that, yeah, maybe it wasn't paralyzed at all, and this was a seizure the whole time. You know, there's no way to know that. But the hard part, what I think it boils down to, and what I imagine you're going to talk about here in a little bit, is even if it was a strong narcotic OD, even if it was a seizure and wound up being, you know, this thing.
Yeah.
Regardless, you observed clear deficits on one side.
Yes.
I don't know, man. I don't think there's a choice. I think this is a stroke activation.
I think that is. So here's, you know, like we all like to be right. You know, like we, you know, it's like, I don't think that, like I've gone on calls.
I'm getting tired of it personally. It happens so often.
Like, like I go on call, like I've gone on calls where I'm like, I don't think this is really a stroke. Like, I think there is a, you know, psychosomatic piece there, or, you know, like, or Bell's palsy, you know, that's another, one where you're like, wow, look at that, you know, holy facial droop, Batman.
Yeah.
But, the thing I think is that it's like, you can still say, hey, stroke activation, right-sided deficits, you know, facial droop, et cetera, et cetera. And then when you get there, you can say, hey, guys, I activated this as a stroke, but I have some other history or some other details that might confound that. Here you go. You guys figure it out. That's what the hospital, we do not have the capabilities. And so I think I used to be the guy who would, you know, like, I'm like, you know what? I'm taking the risk. I'm not going to activate it because I don't think this is it.
I
don't want to be wrong. And I'd get to the hospital and, as far as I know, I was right. No one called me and were like, wow, you really fucked up the stroke call. You had one job. But, I'd go and I'd sell my case and they'd go, yeah, interesting. And they're like, yeah, let's get him to CT and see what's going on. But I think really, like, you don't need to worry about being wrong. You just say, hey, I'm doing this because this is the most, like, this is the worst case scenario that it could be, even if it's below what I think the primary diagnosis actually is. I just don't have a good way of ruling that out. Let's get them to the hospital emergently. Let's activate the system so that they can make that determination there. And if it is a stroke, no one is getting delayed, right? Care is not being stopped or halted in any fashion. So I think that's the takeaway, is do what this medic did. You know, I think based on the initial approach to this patient, that they very much believe that this was a narcotic overdose from the start, from the time of they're not dead to their arrival. And I have some points, but they saw these things and they went, well, shit, I'm calling this a stroke. And even when it changed, they didn't call the hospital back and be like, hey, guys, it's better.
Probably not. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting. I mean, I do want to kind of admonish the hospital a little bit for getting grumpy. Cause it's just, it's a grumpiness that stems from not considering any perspective but your own. But I do have, some criticisms a little bit about some of the treatment and whatnot, not necessarily criticisms, but maybe just more so things more along the lines of questions, if you will.
Okay.
So, but let's kind of keep going down here before I jump to that, because I want to talk a little bit about let's go to system problems. You'd said there's no RSI in this system.
There is not RSI in this system.
All right. We've talked about this before. I especially like this system seems like paradise until we said that. I always want to wonder what it stems from. And I usually think I know. And that is that RSI is one of those things that has a good, it is It is dangerous. Of course it is. You know, I'm not going to pretend that, you know, taking away somebody's ability to breathe and then hoping you can replace it in time before you cause damage, irreversible damage or death. I'm not going to pretend that that's not dangerous, you know.
Like Indiana Jones with a bag of sand.
Right. Exactly. Trying to in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. You know, it's the same thing. But. I think what the issue when it comes down to RSI is that the benefits of doing it are hard to find on a broad system level, you know, in terms of statistics. And the training to do it right to minimize the risk is expensive. You know, and people who say it isn't expensive are people who probably aren't considering, are probably just aren't aware of all the cost that go into training. There's a lot of cost that goes in. Even if, you know, even if it's just like, hey guys, it's 15 minutes, that's 15 minutes of payroll for every single employee. And this is going to be more than 15 minutes if you're doing it right. It takes a lot of protocol development. Well, you got to pay doctors to go in and do that stuff. And, I'm not, by the way, I'm not saying that the financial barrier justifies not doing it, but what I'm saying is that, if you are a agency that is currently realizes that every transport isn't a bill, it's a lottery ticket to see if you'll get a bill, and that's getting harder, not easier, as time goes on, you are not looking to spend more money. And when you mess up an RSI and it goes right, or it goes wrong, when you mess up an RSI and it goes right, when you mess up an RSI and it goes wrong.
And it goes awry. Yeah, that's where you were going. Awry, not right. Awry. Yeah, yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Thanks. Anyway, so right, and it goes wrong. There's a direct path to liability when it comes to RSI. You did a thing, and that thing led to a poor outcome. So when you're an agency, you're looking at it's expensive to train, at least to be able to do it right, to do it to train to a point that we reduce our liability by reducing the errors. Or when there are errors, we're not having these huge hypoxic events, you know, because we pre-oxygenated correctly. If we don't do it right, there's a huge chunk of liability. And my source of income is progressively challenged year after year because, again, transports are not bills anymore. It's lottery tickets. You don't know if you're actually going to get it paid because insurance companies are constantly battling you to deny insurance claims, which means you're going to have to chase people for the bills and they may not have that money and you can't collect what isn't there. And if you send them to collections, you're only going to get a portion. By then, you've been paying your billing staff so much to go chase them, you've lost any profit that you might as well make. So that is the problem behind RSI, is that it's very hard to show the benefits, it's very easy to show the liability, and it's very hard to train. And so it's one of those things where I guess I answer my own question. I don't really need to know where this comes from. It probably comes from that. That's probably it. You know, because my question goes back, if someone says, well, you know, we shouldn't allow, because what I always dislike is that people be like, well, gosh, paramedics shouldn't be doing this in the field. And it's like, okay, so should we not be doing it in hospitals either? Well, no, the doctors, they can do it. Okay, what's special about doctors? Well, they got more schooling. It wasn't all an innovation, motherfucker. It wasn't like 8 years of learning how to tube. That's not what it was, you know? In fact, a lot of them are probably like, oh, I haven't done a tube in a while, but you're not going to stop that doctor from doing it. You know, and so what I don't like about it is it seems to be whenever EMS does something, it's all eyes are on us because we're doing something in a weird environment. And so everyone wants to watch how this works and nobody's watching how it goes elsewhere, you know?
Yeah.
So I always kind of balk at that where it's kind of like, hey, look, if you can train one person to do it right in one environment, can't you train somebody else to do it right in another environment? And case in point is that there are EMS systems out there that don't have these poor outcomes that are related to intubation, that do have great first pass success rate, that do have great protocols and training around these things. And so what I think is the problem is we like to look at averages nationwide and we're like, oh, well, the average is that there's not a lot of benefit to intubating somebody or the average is that we're not doing very well in intubations. It's like, okay, well, that's the average. See who's above average and see if you can mimic that.
Yeah.
You know? And so anyway.
I think my frustration with this is like, it's more along the lines of there are a subset of patients for which this skill and this procedure is the answer.
Yeah.
You know, like to avoiding downstream harm or death. And we're just like, nah. And And I understand, you know, all of the points you brought up, they're valid points. You know, I don't like them, but they're valid.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, my worry is that, you know, it's going to be, you know, the governor's son
yeah.
that dies. And then that's when they'll figure it out. They'll be like, why couldn't they do this thing that other places can do this? And we're like, yeah, it's just, it's yeah. hard. And that's when it'll change. And they'll just, it'll go over the bodies of yeah. all the other people that have.
Yeah. right. Well, I think there's a window where that will happen. Right. Because the problem is that what happens like, well, hey, why weren't we able to do this when other people can do it? It's like, well, some other people are doing it. Most don't because there's not a lot of data to prove that it helps. And we could probably make a case that it wouldn't have saved your son. You know, I mean, you're hoping yeah. for a narrow event to happen before. And if fewer and fewer agencies are doing RSI, then that window gets smaller and smaller, right? Like, or gets easier and easier to be yeah. like, actually, a lot of people don't do this. I mean, yes, some do, but a lot don't, yeah. you know? So
it's
and I will tell you this, and this is where I get controversial, maybe. I know a little bit of controversy.
Cause it feels so empty without me.
yeah. All right, Eminem. Anyway, a little bit of controversy here. And I will say this, if we don't, a little bit of controversy here, if we don't as an EMS agency or as an EMS profession, if we don't get good at intubation, if there isn't some kind of coverage or more secure funding to where we actually train to do intubations well, then we shouldn't have it.
Yeah.
And that sucks to say that. But if our agencies are not going to put the money, resources, and training behind doing what is a dangerous intervention, if they're not going to do that and it results in patient harm, then no, we should not have intubation. I don't want to see that, but it's getting hard to stand on the side of someone who I'm proficient with tubing. I work at an agency that absolutely funds the crap out of training so that we can be proficient with intubations, you know, yeah. and we have a great first pass success rate. Our agency does, you know, like these are all good things that we have, but it's hard for me to stand, you know, where I stand on intubation. And also acknowledge that there are many, many agencies out there who are not doing that level of training.
Yeah.
I it's a controversial thing that gets harder and harder to justify, not necessarily, you know, based on whether or not it has any benefit, but more so based on that any benefits it does have are being squandered by an environment that is not adequately training people to intubate or prepare patients for intubation correctly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah,
no, I agree with that.
How about that pregame?
That was a very solid pregame.
I liked it.
I like the addition of, you know, like, that, you know, hey, if it's a code, these are the roles we're going to take. And then, you know, I'm imagining Brainy Scarecrow is like, what about calcium if they're on dialysis? I don't know that this is the case, but this is how I'm rewriting it in my head.
Okay.
And then Dorothy's like, yeah, no, obviously, of course, calcium.
yeah.
Because that's the benefit to having a paramedic student, like, as your partner or, you know, someone who's learning is that they bring things to mind that you're like, you know, like, yeah, it's in there, but it's in the forefront because they have a test on it on Tuesday.
Absolutely. I am not going to pretend that I have not had I've not done this old FTO trick where an intern asks a question and you're like, all right, well, what would you give for this patient? You know, and it's like, I'm just sitting there like, I'm the great trainer. Like, no, you, what would you give this patient? If you don't know the answer, I want you to look it up so you can remember it. Yeah. Because I don't either.
And then tell me, I want to double check. Yeah, for sure.
No. It's like, I'm going to quiz you on it later on. So make sure you know.
Yeah.
All right. What did we learn? Just so you know, if you are an intern on an ambulance somewhere and your FTO, your trainer pulls that on you, there's a good chance they don't know either. So if you want to have some fun and don't really care if you pass or not, then, you know, just make something up and see what they say.
Or, you know, commit and go look up, you know, make one up and then look up the legitimate one. Yeah. And then just see, like a pill and cheese, see if you could slip it to your...
to your hot, dog.
Cold water to the face, yeah. All right. So let's jump to the, let's move on to the arrival assessment portion of the call. I want to bring this up as I think this is overall, they found the life threat. They identified it. They treated and transported appropriately. But when they first got there, they got out of their ambulance, sans equipment, went right to the patient. Granted, you know, the patient's right there. I'd probably do the same thing. But I think based on the details we have of, you know, them trying to get the patient to stand up and like move over to the stretcher before really being able to do any kind of like solid assessment. You know, like check for a pulse and see if it's, you know, strong, regular, etc. I think those actions kind of showcase a person who was like, oh, it's this guy. It's probably an overdose. Like, they're not dead. It's probably an overdose.
Right.
And they looked for those signs. And, you know, like, listen, they might not be wrong. And that's, you know, but that's the 4-year medic catch, right?
Right.
Where it's like, yeah, you're probably right, but you just skipped a lot of steps to get to that point. And some of those steps can protect the patient from harm. Or, you know, like you missed an opportunity to cut. And so my concern here is like, again, and they admitted to this, like, yeah, I thought it was this. And, you right. know, like we got him into the back and then I looked at his pupils and I was like, yeah, they're pinpoint. And he's taking shallow, slow respirations. Like, okay, like we are compiling a really compelling case for that, but we're not looking at the other things. Like we were compiling that before we were like, oh, look at that facial droop. Oh, you know, and that's, I think that's the part that if you're going to do an assessment, have a very systematic approach and make sure that it's like, you're not letting your ideas detract from doing that solid assessment. So like in, you know, the case here, it's like, hey, we're having the patient stand up before we really have an idea of why they are not as responsive. Mm-hmm. And like, yes, the, I thought of, hey, they're probably using drugs. That's a fair one. But if it's not that, and we're having this person stand up, we don't know why they're unconscious. Maybe it's a fuel issue. And then we're adding an unnecessary risk by trying to have them stand up when they're not even really being like coherently following commands. So, yeah. So I think this is just an example to showcase something that we see in EMS a lot.
Right.
And you know, again, no harm came to the patient. I think this is a very very human thing to do. We just have to be careful of it. So, near miss on this end. Yeah.
Yeah. Near miss. And then maybe some direct hits actually. Hang on. I've got a take. So one of the things that I kind of want to point out is that I don't know that I would have run this call this same way, even if this was a narcotics overdose from the get-go. So assessment aside, because like you said, we really did kind of bullet point on specific assessments. Like we kind of went and looked for the things that would say overdose, right?
Yeah.
And then confirmed that they were there. I do agree that there's a good chance this guy could be having all of these things, right? Like that's totally there.
Yeah.
And earlier I did mention how like, hey, like when we have someone with this history, they're actually more likely to have these problems. And if there's someone who is frequently stoned, then there's a good chance that they're going to have this issue while stoned. You know, like if you spend a good section of your day intoxicated, it's almost inevitable that when you do have that stroke that you are at more risk for than anybody else, than most other people, there's a good chance that you're going to be intoxicated when it occurs. So, with that, a couple things that probably should have been done differently. And the question I have to ask is, all right, let's say you get in there and this is a narcotics overdose. I don't recall ever putting the patient on oxygen with 90% saturation. They did?
Oh, they did. Yeah. Okay. Right away. They put them on 4 liters at the start of transport.
Yes. Gotcha. Was there ever a follow-up SpO2 mentioned?
Yes, there was. It went from the low 90s to the high 90s.
Okay. Oh yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. Well. All right. Well. Fair enough. I'm glad. I'm glad they did that, because that really takes out the rest of my the rest of my this shortens the episode by quite a bit. Really actually,
takes so, the oxygen out of your.
It does. It takes the oxygen out of my nose. But anyway, yeah. Because what I was going to say is. Hey, why are we? Well, of course, that actually does kind of come to my next point. I do want to mention is that if you have a narcotics overdose patient and they are ventilating appropriately, strongly reconsider your usage of Narcan. In this case, it probably still would have been appropriate. I would have been worried about airway protection for this guy. You know, I mean, his airway wasn't a problem now, but when they're that zonked out, like, I don't know, vomiting might be right around the corner. And now we really are in a pickle. But I just want to make the point in general, for me, I always titrate my Narcan. Now in this case, titration is difficult, right? Because I imagine their protocol says, hey, it's 2 milligrams in the nose. That's how it works. And without an IV, because a lot of protocols, you get an IV and you're going to give a half milligram and you're going to give another half and another half until it comes up. Neither here nor there.
Yeah.
So that would be kind of my only take. So the other thing I would add is when you have a bystander that's saying, oh my God, I think he's dead, make sure you take time at some point to address that bystander, because they're fearing for somebody's life and that's a terrible feeling to have. So if you're able to say like, hey, just so you know, it looks like he's not dead. We're just trying to figure out what's going on with him. He's got some vital signs that are actually pretty good. We just got to figure out why he's not responding, but he's not dead. Okay. Because that's a worthwhile, it's worthwhile to take that time and to do that.
Yeah.
My final point.
That might have happened here, but that's a very solid point.
Yep. And if it did happen, awesome. But and if you're out there, but make sure we're addressing family members. My final point here on this is at one point we were about to go and we started kicking firefighters out of the ambulance.
Yeah.
Consider taking a rider on this patient. Because we're already talking about someone who, let's say it is a CVA. Well, it's a CVA that's causing some amount of respiratory compromise and dropping our SpO2 levels down, they could be that way because we've aspirated. There's interesting reasons on why that could be. If you're thinking it's a CVA and you have low SpO2 with that, and 90% is not like dirt low. You and I have both seen much lower in our careers.
Yeah.
But 90%, especially with like low effort, it's questionable. You're like, why is this guy 90%? Should he be 90%? Especially if we know this patient, we've been on them before. Do they typically run 90%? And if not, your brain has to start questioning, if this is a stroke, what is dropping this patient's O2 saturations? Okay. Is it because they aspirated just prior to the stroke? Is there something else going on? And at which point you really start to wonder, is airway protection in my future? And do I want to do that by myself?
Yeah.
So if you have a stroke that's bad enough to the point that where the patient's somnolent, unable to follow your commands, unable to protect their own airway, consider taking a rider with you instead of kicking them out.
And the rider becomes a witness at the hospital when they're like, they saw it too.
Bonus. Bonus point. Yeah, absolutely. Or they throw you under the bus immediately, being like, yeah, I didn't think it was anything either.
I think it was a stroke. I had a
partner do that to me once. It irritated me. But that patient ended up actually having a stroke, and it was the best. They came in, and the nurses were like, oh, it smells like alcohol to me, doing that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then the doc's like, all right, well, let's take him to CT just to make sure. And it's like, fuck, he's having a stroke. And I'm just like, boom. But before that, my partner's like, that's what I smelled too. And I was pissed at her because I was like, hey, you didn't share that one. You never told me that. And three, that's kind of a shitty time to come in and say it. And then later on, the patient had a stroke. I didn't find out about the stroke till later. And I called that person who I never work with. I was like, hey, that person we had ended up having a stroke. And they're like, oh, I'm like, yeah, there you go. It's petty, but I'm glad I did it. All right. With that, let's talk about BLS on this one. When it comes to BLS, Narcan, this was actually kind of a BLS call.
Aside from the IV attempts. Yeah.
Aside from the IV attempts, which effectively we are BLS call. This is a BLS call plus lacerations. That's what, or puncture wounds,
punctures,
I suppose.
Punctures. Yeah.
So that's pretty much it. With that, Spence, give us the follow-up.
All right. So, here's the thing. No follow-up except the patient died.
Oh, that's.
But several months later and unrelated to this event.
Oh, okay.
yeah.
I'm like, that is follow up, dude. Like, how did he die?
No, it sounds like, and I did ask, I was like, cause I was picking on, poor Dorothy at this point. Cause I was like, all right. And then everybody got out the champagne and celebrated this.
Yeah.
This guy's passing. And they were like, no, but there was a systematic sigh of relief.
Yeah. A systematic sigh of relief. I will put that way. No, I think we should make it clear that kind of to back up our statement earlier is that people are people and that everyone that, that wound up like this guy who was grumpy and angry, was once like an innocent kid and then things drove them this way. And yeah.
Like that movie Wicked that I haven't seen. And so I'm hoping I'm quoting it correctly.
Yeah, maybe. But you know, it is one of those things where it's like, yeah, we've headed this direction. I'm not saying it absolves people from taking responsibility for their own actions. It doesn't. Like we said at the beginning, you know, I mean, your behaviors may be understandable, but that doesn't make them excusable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we have to understand that, you know, when these people pass, there needs to be a level of compassion because essentially you're looking at someone that never really made it out. You know, they sadly died as angry and as unresolved as they lived, and they never were able to turn over that leaf. And so in a way, we kind of lose one. At the same time, I would be remiss if the systemic sigh of relief did not hit appropriately. That's that is one of those no, things where it's like,
I think both things can be true at the same time.
Absolutely. But yes, both things can be true. All right. With that, everybody, thanks again for listening to yet another episode of EMS 2020. I am at Fast Canada right now as you are listening to this. Thank you to Medic Grants Coffee for your sponsorship of a funny commercial that I'm hoping you're seeing right about now. And yeah, if you are at Fast Canada right now, come find me. I'll be out walking around. With that, everybody, thank you. And we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.